This is the End User, Episode 3 for Thursday, February 25th, the Tres Amigos Especial. Hello and welcome to the End User, Episode number 3. I am your host, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Metal Charlie.
And I'm Taylor Mark.
We got plenty of tech news to slice and dice for you today.
So much.
What do you guys think?
It's almost too much.
Too much? I think we
it's not really too much.
I think we've got a pretty good lineup going here.
So there are a lot of sevens.
We can handle it.
There are a lot of sevens and series and phones and Windows and seven phone series, Windows 7 phone.
For all its greatness, did they have to be so obtuse in naming it? I mean, really.
They always have been for some reason. I'm not quite sure why, but they by the way, for anyone who doesn't get the joke, we're talking about the newly released Windows Phone 7 series. Ooh. So, there's plenty of features to talk about here.
It sounds like a BMW.
Yeah,
no, BMW stands for something. That's just a bunch of they never had to add.
The Windows Phone...
What, the 7 series?
Windows Phone 7 series? Everybody knows that, like, 7 denotes it's in sequence.
Like BMW?
I see. You mean as in the 7 series.
They have 3 series, 7 series, 5 series.
Yeah, but it doesn't say that on the badge.
That's true. I think they want you to say Windows Phone.
I'm just not buying it. But I think we should talk about its interface and features. What do you think, Chris?
So this new interface they've come up with, basically... They took the trash can that was Windows Mobile 6.5 and threw it out in the dumpster. They completely overhauled everything. This is a complete...
Now, remind me what operating system you're using on your phone, Chris?
Windows Mobile 6.5.3, which is yet
so
to be released.
Much better than...
Yes, actually, it is much better. There's a reason why I'm using a custom ROM on 6.5.3. Because it's one of the builds that's optimized for capacitive screens. Even though I don't have a capacitive screen, it gives me the big finger-friendly buttons that any modern operating system should have on a phone. But this new, Windows Phone Series 7. Okay, I got it. I'll remember it from now on, I swear. It has a new interface called the Metro interface. And what do you guys think? You know...
I hope it's not the DC Metro interface.
That, I guarantee you, it is not. If it took 30 minutes for the Twitter app to launch like the DC Metro does, I don't think that would be a very good experience.
And in Microsoft's experience, that would be the least of their problems.
But basically, this is the Zune phone. This is what everybody... kind of envisioned the Zune phone being. You know, the Zune HD came out and everybody said, oh, that's great, but it doesn't hold a candle to the iPod Touch because, you know, it doesn't have all the apps and all this kind of stuff. And this, by all rights, you know, it's kind of what everybody thought the Zune HD should have been.
Well, I think to be fair, even from an Apple user, the Zune HD gets enormous street cred. It was a wonderful interface, and from the looks of it, they did right with Windows Phone 7 series.
I think that was a test bed for them. I think the Zune HD was a test bed. I'm not sure they really wanted to sell that device in their fullest capacity.
Yeah, and I want to point out that there is one massive drawback for Microsoft on this phone, and that is, unlike the Zune, which they actually control and manufacture, they do not control and manufacture this phone.
No, they partner with hardware OEMs like they always have, but they do set very strict specifications as to... So they're almost taking a middle ground here, you know, where Apple says, we're going to make it, we're going to control it, we're going to do this. Android says, do whatever the hell you want. And this is kind of a middle ground where it's a little bit of both. You know, they say there are three chassis that you can have, and the minimum spec is to the decimal point. You know, it is very strict. We talked about this last week, or was it the first episode? Anyways,
we've been talking about Windows 7 since forever.
That's true. So what I did find interesting, beyond all the just kind of shock and awe of something new, you know, which always kind of happens, they did not ditch the what in Windows Mobile 6.5 is the today screen. Some kind of glanceable, they say glanceable, even though it's not a word, but some kind of glanceable screen where you get all of the information that is relevant to your communicating device. And this is something that the iPhone doesn't have. You know, you get the grid launcher. So, you know, that's something that's always held me away from the iPhone, among a couple other things. But, you know, I really...
Yeah, but to be fair, that juxtaposition is a little off because this kind of phone interface didn't exist when you were rejecting the iPhone. Let's be honest about that.
That's absolutely true. When the iPhone first came out, it was lacking features, but it was a new kind of paradigm. There's no denying that. But this is Gizmodo said. Here, let me get a quote here.
And we know that Gizmodo is not exactly Microsoft friendly. Always.
No, they're usually.
So if Gizmodo says something good, then they mean it.
I'm trying to find this quote, which I know is excellent radio to sit silent and and try.
Rush Limbaugh would never do that, Chris. I really need to be bellicose right now and just scream rampantly while you look for the quote.
Well,
what do you think, Taylor?
I think there's a lot that we still don't know about Windows 7, and but from
Phone
what I've
Series
seen so
7.
Far. Windows Phone 7 series.
Yeah, that one too.
What we do know, from what we do know, it seems like they haven't gone far enough with integration of Microsoft services, which I think would be their best competitive advantage.
So you think they should tie into all of their live services and that kind of thing? Hotmail, stuff like
that. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I know that they're going to do a few of those things. Like, they've already talked about getting Microsoft Office onto Windows Phone.
Yep. And that was part of their...
They've talked about Bing a little bit. And they've talked about ActiveSync. But I think that they could go a lot further in terms of integration.
Are we talking about the Office suite? Are we talking about what are you specifically looking for?
I mean, I just in terms of the way that they integrate things into the phone. I mean, so we've seen these start screens, these hubs, but you know, we've not seen the way that the phone will actually interact with all of the Microsoft services. And I think it's something that, you know, you buy a Windows phone and you get, you know, Windows services in the cloud at all times. They might have that, but they haven't. If they do have that, they're not advertising it.
Yeah, they have a pretty extensive, at least for Windows Mobile 6.5, they have a pretty extensive Microsoft Live app suite or whatever they may call it. It's probably something more ridiculous than what I just said, Windows Live app suite. It's probably something even worse than that.
Well, you know, there are articles. There are a lot of people who are up in arms about designing for the Windows phone, specifically developers.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of that, and I got to say, I don't really get it. I mean, what's going on? I can't see that perspective. What's going on there?
You know, it didn't seem particularly clear to me. I think that they were miffed specifically about the designer kit. But, you know, all of that can change.
The SDK?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know. I'm not really sure why that's the case. I mean, you know, it's got a bunch of... they use the Silverlight. One of the things that is a little strange is the Silverlight. That you use that, because that's an extremely proprietary thing. You don't see it very often, except for maybe the Olympics, which we're experiencing now. But, you know...
I don't know. I think Silverlight integration is actually a really smart move.
Well, I have specific views about Silverlight and Flash integration, not the least of which them being security vulnerabilities. But it's good to see one of the phones.
Well, Ballmer has said that Flash is not going to be on Windows Phone 7 series, right?
That's correct. But Silverlight does, in fact, include a tremendous number of the security vulnerabilities that Flash lends itself to, not the least of which is a type of cookie or storage document called Flash cookies, specifically called locally shared objects, which allow people to drop various codes into your computer or, in this case, phone at a whim.
Yeah, so the Silverlight I'm not so hot on. I think
vulnerabilities are nothing new.
Yeah, that's true.
Not to Windows.
Yeah, one would think that a company would respond to security alerts like that.
Well, anyway, this is the age of, everything changes. We've got a computer in our hands and viruses are bound to happen. People breaking into them is bound to happen. Cloud break-ins are bound to happen. I don't think that should be a detractor from the phone, which looks in all honesty, quite fabulous.
So anyways, we've got some more phone news to talk about. This is all coming out of the Mobile World Congress that is in Barcelona. Last week, Wednesday, they had the event. HTC came out with, they're big. They make my phone. They make plenty of Windows phones. They also make some pretty excellent Android handsets. They were the first Android handset, if I'm not mistaken, with the G1. But they've come out with the HTC Legend, which is basically an updated HTC Hero. And they've come out with the HTC Desire, which is more or less a Google Nexus One, but with the HTC custom interface. What do you guys think about HTC Sense on Android? Thumbs up, thumbs down? What do you think?
I mean, they love it. They're all about it, and they have an extremely close design relationship with Google and the Android developers. So, thumbs up to them. There are clearly some bugs still to be worked out in Android, and I have certain reservations as to any company's ability to bring online 52 different chipsets and GPU combinations and then make a mobile marketplace work. But Android's dominant. Android's doing great things.
They're all either ARM or Tegra.
Yeah.
So,
but that's not going to be the case for long. We're going to start seeing.
We're going to see Intel's Moore's Town coming out pretty soon.
Some dual core chipsets, some interesting stuff.
Well, the dual core is still ARM. That's the next generation Snapdragon ARM processor. That's still the ARM architecture.
Well, it's going to be interesting.
Anyways, did you guys watch the videos? It's okay if you didn't, but did you watch the videos on the end of these Engadget posts?
I did not. I've got it queued up right now.
Yeah, I know you didn't really have time to before you came in here, Taylor, to watch extensive amounts of video. Although, Charlie, I'll hold you to it.
Oh, I totally watched that video, the both of them. They were awesome.
Now,
yeah.
Here's a gripe. Here is an Android gripe. I think...
So what do you think of the Sense UI?
I think it's cool, and I think it would be something that I would like the option to turn off. I think it would be more. It's better suited for a situation like Windows Mobile, where you have a Today screen where you can swap elements in and out. And if I have the option, which I do, of running HTC Sense on Windows Mobile, I can use it. Or if I don't want to use it, I don't have to use it. Now, I like that freedom. So it's nice looking, but I'm a little lukewarm on it just because I can't. It's not up to me to use the device how I want to use it. That's a little upsetting to me, especially with an open source operating system like Android is. You'd think you'd be able to tweak to your heart's desire.
Well,
I think that with Android, you can't try to create your own interface that's competing with an interface that anybody else could create. Android is, it's an open platform. You're competing with every developer out there. And, you know, who is HTC to say that they have the best and to limit you to only use their interface?
They're the manufacturer of the phone.
Yeah, I mean, Apple says the same thing. They say,
well, it's a whole lot different. I will say this, that sense is allowed to masquerade is certainly a byproduct of Apple and the iPhone breaking the hold of carriers upon design specifications. But the, you know, iPhone all the way through to its core is an Apple design, including its operating system. Whereas the HTC Sense is sort of an augmentation of the open platform that is Android.
That's very true. At least they did bump up the operating system underneath Sense to the 2.1. I want a keyboard. Is that
you love those keyboards? I'm not. I don't need one.
No, Taylor. Clearly, neither of you need one. You're iPhone users.
I don't either. I need one. I tried using one on the Palm Pre, and I just I can't use it.
Oh well, you can't hold up the Palm Pre's keyboard as an example of a real keyboard. I mean, you'd have to use your pinkies instead of your thumbs to even be any halfway decent on that thing.
I got the stubby little hands. I don't need a keyboard. I just need somebody to interpret what the stubby little hands are doing. And yes. And as long as it's doing it well, then I don't care. But for the most part, I'm very happy with a small touchscreen. That's where I'm at. But that's also, I know for you, you are very much driven by function. I, in a large part, am driven by both form and, you know, function. So aesthetics are important. And to add weight by sliding out a keyboard that's only half functional, it's not paramount to me.
Yeah, I can understand it. Maybe it's because I've had these keyboards on all my devices, you know, pretty much up to now, and I still have a keyboard. So, you know,
we should take you to one of those Japanese boot camps to get kids off video games, but in this case, get you off of Windows Mobile.
Get me off of Windows. Well, you know,
yeah, we'll force you to use an iPhone for like 3 weeks. It'll be crazy.
I wouldn't want to use an iPhone, but I got to say, the Android stuff is starting to look better to me than even the Windows Phone 7 series stuff, because, you know, the reason I like Windows Mobile is because I can flash a custom ROM. I can do all this kind of stuff. On Android, you can flash a custom ROM. You can put the HTC Sense UI on the Nexus One, for example, and you can do all these crazy things that hackers do. So, you know, traditionally for in the phone market, even before Android was around, that platform was Windows Mobile, and there's a huge community of developers that are committed to giving you options. And even though it's not open source, it had an open source like community, which is kind of bizarre, but that's why it was always so attractive to me. I have an army of nerds at my disposal.
Because Windows Mobile has been historically completely and profoundly poorly functioning.
Well, they were competitive with Palm OS, Garnet.
Yeah, but I mean, Palm's experienced a pretty profound decline as well.
Yeah, now Microsoft has as well. You know, it's all a circle of life.
It is, and hopefully Series 7 will bring them back around, and we'll see a lot more competition in the marketplace. Speaking of competition in the marketplace, I do have some things to say about the Apple iPhone.
Yeah, it's damn near time to move on from all of that business. I just get excited because I like this stuff. But
I know you do, and we do too. I mean, who doesn't like a bit of gadget that really improves your life? You're not going to hear any responses from you two.
So what's up with the iPhone these days?
The iPhone is going to get some major upgrades. You know, ever since and previous to the release of the iPad, which we've sort of commented upon, I'll put it like that. There have been lots of rumors about what's going to happen next. You know, it's going to be a different screen. It's going to be bigger. It's going to have a forward-facing camera so you can video chat. It's going to have dual cores and go real fast and do all sorts of wonderful things. Well, at least in terms of code, we do have some clarity. In a recent SDK release for the iPhone, the developers uncovered a bit of code that alluded to pretty specifically video chat capability coming up in the fourth generation of iPhones. They saw code that said, quote unquote, decline or end video satfeb.png. I mean, these are things that you can't mistake. So I think it is fair to say that the next generation of iPhone, which will be coming out summerish along the lines of, you know, when Apple's commitment to AT&T breaks, we're going to start seeing a phone with a forward-facing camera allowing for video chat. There are other rumors saying that, you know, because of this video camera, it's going to be ever so slightly taller. And there are certainly rumors about the iPhone jumping ship from AT&T, keeping it on AT&T as well, but also making a version, keeping in mind that AT&T and Verizon operate fundamentally different kinds of packet handoff technology, which is essential for how a phone functions. There would have to be a second version of the phone. So it's this distinct possibility we could see two fourth generation iPhones, one for AT&T and one for Verizon's network operating on CDMA. I certainly think we're going to see a video camera. I'm not sure.
This seems pretty clear cut, whether it's for the iPad or the iPhone, but I'm not really sure about Verizon's, they're kind of bastards when it comes to having control over what's on their network. And I think that would turn Steve Jobs off is all.
Well, in fact, I have a good story about that. iPhone, basically, does everybody else remember the Motorola Rocker? It was a piece of junk manufactured, you know, by Motorola, but it had iTunes embedded in it. This was the very first time when Apple said, hey, maybe we can venture into the mobile marketplace. And the phone was such a disaster, operated on what is now the AT&T platform, that they said, we're not gonna take this anymore. We're going to build our own phone. And when they built their own phone, the first-gen iPhone, they said, hey, Verizon, come take a look at this. And they were in negotiations with Verizon. And Verizon was, as you said, very much a bastard, but in the very same way that all carriers were at the time. They did not want hardware vendors, as they saw them, controlling the operating system of their phone. They wanted to control the operating system, what capabilities were allowed for each user.
Ma Bell era, where they were really monopolistic.
Monopolistic, and they were not – what they really didn't want at that time is to become what's referred to commonly as a dumb pipe. Back in the day when Ma Bell operated also the physical lines, she didn't want certain pieces of hardware operating on our network, and they were very serious about that. Since then, anybody who has a computer that can put it on the internet is allowed to, so long as they pay for the service. That made them what's called dumb pipe. When it came to Verizon being approached by Apple, Verizon said, we're not going to let you control the software.
Verizon said, we want Verizon Navigator on it, or VZW.
We want Verizon Navigator. We will not let you get a piece of each monthly contract profit. We're not going to let you do any of that stuff. And Verizon said, you know, sorry, we're going somewhere else. They didn't actually say it like that. It was more like Steve Jobs, happy birthday, Steve Jobs, saying, go, you know, blank yourself.
Although we should explain that we're time travelers. If you say happy birthday, Steve Jobs.
On this side of the podcast, it is indeed Steve Jobs' birthday. When you listeners listen to it, it will, alas, no longer be Steve Jobs' birthday.
It depends on how late I'm staying up editing, whether or not it would still be Steve Jobs' birthday.
I don't think it's going to be Steve Jobs' birthday, but I think we should pave on. Because what happened was, Apple did something different. They said, we're going to go to another network. They did. AT&T agreed to share profits per contract. They agreed to let Apple control the software, and they controlled it through a completely peripheral system. They changed the game. Verizon's immediate response after the unbelievable success of the iPhone, second generation iPhone, was to say, hey, people, everyone, if you can make a phone that works on our network, we're going to allow you to do it. You just need a contract. They realized their error. Going back to whether we're going to see iPhones on Verizon.
Well, they said they didn't catch.
I'm sorry about that.
Uh-oh. Did we lose him?
Verizon said that they were going to allow a dumb pipe. And they've started taking steps towards it. But I'm sure that Chris could tell us that they're not just letting any phone onto their network with any contract that they like.
Well, that's certainly true. Their contracts have grown extremely specific, down to, you know, megabytes per month. But it's also – they're hampered by the fact that they operate a network that is fairly unique. There are only a couple other places on the planet that operate a CDMA network. And that use that specific handoff technology, which goes to the point of while Verizon is enormous in the United States, it is questionably likely that we're going to see AT&T or the iPhone migrate directly to Verizon in the immediate future. However, the fourth generation of wireless spectrum, something called LTE, will be unleashed across all of the United States networks and presumably the European Union and the Asian countries as well, which would make it extremely profitable for the iPhone to be unleashed with that capability. But that's going to be a while, and I think we're going to see some divergent network behavior.
It is. It's going to be until
it's going to be the end of 2011 before that's really.
I like your terminology there. LTE will be unleashed across America and Europe.
Well, it's going to be unbelievable. It's going to be like nothing we've seen before. We're going to see extreme speeds. We're going to see a consistent network across the carriers, which will make competition that much more important or that much more likely. And, you know, we're gonna see higher uploads and faster downloads. You know, it's going to be revolutionary.
This out. I just on the fly here pulled up a ZDNet blog article here from Larry Dignan. He's pretty good. Verizon Wireless 4G LTE trials showing 50 to 60 megabit download rates.
That's right.
You know, guess what we're recording this podcast across? My connection.
Much less than that.
5 megabits.
5 megabits? Come on now, Chris.
It actually runs at about 7. Yeah, it actually runs at about 7.
But. Let's be personal here. Chris, you and I are both on RCN. Is that the case?
Yeah.
Yeah. And Taylor, you're who's your provider?
Comcast Xfinity.
Oh, yes, the wonderful Comcast Xfinity. My favorite. Really just great people. Love the internet. Really want to preserve free speech. So, don't want to mess with your, you know, Taylor, navigating habits.
Taylor, I must ask you, does Wolverine do a good job of shaping your web traffic? Oh, he's on the delay.
Yes, with his adamantium claws, he slices and dices to his desires.
Fantastic. You Excellent. Know, I mean, as long as he's got a cigar, Wolverine's happy. Speaking of which... I think there's some big Verizon news coming up. Is that not the case, Taylor?
Well, we were talking about how Verizon is starting to make baby steps towards becoming a dumb pipe open network. And they're doing that. They continue to do that in ways, tiny, tiny ways that don't seem to hurt their revenue. They've announced that starting next month, smartphone users on Verizon with data plans, hint, hint, will be able to make Skype-to-Skype calls.
You talking about
using Verizon's network.
Which is interesting and good for Skype, because to be fair, after their, weren't they sold to eBay?
Yeah, that's right. I forgot
that's
about
right.
that.
eBay couldn't figure out how to make any money off of them. There's not a whole lot of money in a right and proper phone call.
They sold it back to the founders.
That's right, they did. But suddenly somebody's going to make some money.
Yeah. So, you know what? I've had Skype on Windows Mobile for years. So this is they're opening it up for Android is really what they mean. And BlackBerry probably.
Well, Chris, do you know if you could ever use it on 3G before?
I've tried. It's not pretty. I don't know, actually, you know what? Because I have tried, and it is not pretty. But nobody else has phones that can do that. So I'm left out in the dust, being the only one that can really use Skype on over 3G.
Well, it's good that it's going to change. But there are some really interesting implications of Skype over phones. Not the least of which being that, you know, federal authorities have the ability to tap a wireless phone fairly easily, and they can listen in via packets and other information to find out what's going to it. Skype calls are encrypted, and that is going to be hell on wheels for the federal government.
Are they really encrypted? I had no idea we were speaking.
They are encrypted, or at least they certainly can be. And we're talking about high bit rates, the kind of bit rates that would make it difficult for somebody to really tap into a call in real time.
Sure. Well, speaking of tapping into things in
real time. Well, can they record the stream and then decode it later?
It doesn't matter. I mean, in reality, I mean, 128-bit encryption is still incredibly strong. You know, we used to have these friends. This is a good story. We used to have these friends who worked for AOL back in the day when AOL was the big dog. And there was this race between AOL and some people at the NSA to break 128-bit standard encryption.
And that was the other big dog in the race. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, the NSA. Yeah. They've gotten a little bit more sophisticated since then. But AOL, these guys who were doing this totally on their own time and on servers they didn't own, they would operate all those servers at night when there's a lot of downtime, just breaking that encryption. And they won. Can't name who it is, but, you know, that sets the standard when you have a server farm that has 100 million users, you know, something like AOL, and it takes that long to break it. 128-bit encryption over a Skype call over a wireless carrier is going to take forever for anybody looking to break into a case. And I'm not advocating doing anything legal. I'm simply saying 128-bit is still a formidable encryption.
Hey, Charlie, what TrueCrypt encryption bit do you use?
Oh, boy. I know you're talking about that. You know, I use a 512 two-fish Whirlpool encryption.
Sure.
I also use, you know, what's amazing about TrueCrypt is if you've taken a good look at it, they use something called
steganographic.
Yeah, they have steganographic encryption. Are you familiar with steganography? Steganography is the art, essentially, of hiding things in plain sight. So you can create a TrueCrypt volume that's encrypted, and it could have two passwords, only one of which will access a second encrypted volume within the encryption, thereby pretending. Like, for instance, if somebody were to say, hey, you know, give me your password or else, you could give them the dummy password. It would still look like all of the information was laid bare.
It's basically a false bottom kind of thing.
Yes, it is. It's exactly right. But speaking of encryption and spying, I think you are right to move us on. Boy, is anybody else out there listening to this, Pennsylvania school district that's been spying on kids?
Well, it's been on the nightly news. I'm sure most of our listeners have heard of this thing.
That's right. This is now fondly being called Webcam Gate. A school district in Pennsylvania was handing out some MacBooks, and what they didn't tell any of the kids who took them home was that, funny story, we're taking pictures of you while you do this. We're remotely activating the webcam and doing that. And you can imagine that there is a fine line. They sensibly, at least in the first part, they said, you know, we're only doing this in case anybody tries to steal the MacBook. But, I mean, that's sort of a bogus claim because these kids had to log these books in the first place. And they also made it impossible, or at least not allowed for kids to bring their own computers to class. So the kids would take them home, and they didn't know it, but they were being potentially photographed. So one kid specifically – I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
Oh, no, go on with it.
One kid specifically – I mean, this kid was real messed up. He was real deep into Mike and Ike's. I mean, that candy will do you wrong. We're talking about, like, sugar highs and cavities, you know?
It's a gateway treat is what it is.
It is.
It's a gateway treat.
It is. I mean, soon you're going to start smoking those candy cigarettes, and it's going to be all over the place. No, so a kid took, you know, one of the computers home, and while he was in his parents' own home, a place sovereign by most accounts, and protected under the implied privacy, constitutional privacy, they took a picture of him eating Mike and Ike's. The web administrator said, "Oh my God, this kid's doing drugs," because apparently they look like pills. And an administrator called the kid to the office and charged him with doing drugs. So the question was raised, well, how did they know that this kid was doing drugs when he wasn't? And they showed him a picture, and lo and behold, an entire school district has been brought into question, specifically a high school, over whether they were violating federal wiretapping laws, whether there were significant breaches of right to privacy.
There's no question about that.
Not. A federal judge just explicitly told the school district, not only are they under no circumstances to operate this web spying again, they also said, under no circumstances are you to get rid of any information, because they already foresee a class action lawsuit, not just the lawsuit from the kid's parents.
Yeah, they have to keep all of what they have now so that they can use
get
it
sued in the future.
How's that?
It's righteous and just.
I think.
This is standard practice in full.
Uh-oh. Taylor, are you still there?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think we lost him.
We lost him.
Oh, no, I'm still here.
Okay. I'll edit that out. Don't
really
worry.
Going at you hard.
You guys are still talking. It is standard practice in forward-looking courts to issue an injunction on the deletion of all electronic material as soon as a lawsuit gets called into question. Basically, anytime there's any reasonable evidence that a lawsuit might happen. A smart court will issue that injunction.
So, Charlie, you know, none of us are lawyers here, but I think
Taylor's the closest thing.
I think whoever's responsible for what is going on is lucky not to get child pornography and make it some jail time. What do you guys think?
I think they're in hot water, extremely hot water. You know, where the parents can go and their specific suit is questionable. How much damage was actually done? Were there measurable damages? How much money they're going to get? But anytime a school district is sued, it's an awful thing. It's always one stupid decision caused great injustice, and then the lawsuits that ensue, you know, really bring down a school district's ability to actually educate people. So the fact that they did this shows such lack of foresight and such unbelievable bad judgment, you know, that anybody around should say, yeah, they absolutely deserve it, but realize how damaging it's going to be if multiple people sign on to this lawsuit, because undoubtedly these pictures were taken at other people's homes. So it's really sort of a horrible situation all over, in my personal opinion.
So, Charlie, what else do we have in the Department of Horrible Situations?
Fantastic question. Well, boy, I've just got a nursery full of them.
You see what I did there?
Yeah, I think I did. So anybody else out there heard of Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, also known as ACTA, U.S. ACTA, A-C-T-A? Well, I'll tell you what, fellas, it's an awful...
Ladies.
Fellas and ladies. I did not... You know, I really need a gender-neutral one there. Taylor, you got anything for me? Citizens, denizens, people of the world, people of the world.
Dudes and dudettes, I don't know.
Oh, I like that. Dude and dudettes.
Netizens, pretty good.
you know, that really harkens me back to the days of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. And I should simply say, going back to our previous discussion and looking forward upon this one, dudes and dudettes, be excellent to one another, because there's some crazy things going on. And one of them is U.S. ACTA. ACTA is a trade agreement, a wide-branching trade agreement between multiple nations, perpetuated in large part by forces in the United States, let's say Hollywood and the recording industry and a couple of others, to make intellectual property really synonymous with paramount importance in terms of web habits across the across these many countries. And they're doing that by using a multilateral plurilateral trade agreement. What's interesting is that this trade agreement, which would would ostensibly be about anti-counterfeiting, is really much, much more aimed at intellectual property infringement. And it has such wonderful, wonderful possibilities as allowing for a three strikes law with every nation that agrees to it, which is obviously big trouble. It opens the gateway to data sharing, multinational data sharing with regard to infringers. And there's absolutely no transparency. ACTA was first announced under WikiLeaks, a wonderful organization of people who take a lot of risk showing people the ugly side of things that they're not allowed to see.
Who's, by the way, running out of money. So
yeah, absolutely.
They need donations.
People donate to them.
Yeah.
These guys are exposing all of the horrible things that would otherwise go unchecked. But going back to them, you know, recently the EU data protection supervisor basically said, I don't really like this law. There are significant problems. In a 20-page opinion, he said the three strikes law was disproportionate on all circumstances, and he had extreme concerns with regard to enforced data sharing between countries and across borders. You know, I mean, we're talking – when I say data sharing across borders, I mean like when you cross from Mexico into the United States, are those authorities going to check your iPod for stolen music?
Yeah, and the U.S. has the right to do that right now, by the way.
Well, they don't exactly – I mean, they have the right to do it, but the problem is that the U.S. has no the problem, and by problem I mean the good thing, is that they have the right to do it to look for child pornography, among other things. They do not have any reason to do it for whether you have, you know, a stolen Britney Spears song on your –
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, I didn't mean that. I mean they have the right to look at your data.
Well, all I was saying, Chris, is that it's not a big deal that you have stolen Britney Spears on your iPod. No,
actually,
so anyway,
you know what? I may have some Britney Spears. I'll take a look while you're talking, and I'll get back to you.
I really wouldn't confirm that. It's so embarrassing.
Let's see here.
Anyway, so the EU data provider, you know, data protection officer said, you know, I don't like this. Here's 20 pages of why I don't like it. It's a really big and good thing that he came out, because we're talking about a trade agreement that, for all sensible purposes, has not been revealed to the public. One of his biggest problems with it was that this really needs public representation, public input. We're talking about a trade agreement that can be agreed to and ratified by multiple countries without decisions of Congress. It's an ugly thing, and there needs to be transparency. And he also said that three strikes was disproportionate. And let's keep in mind that right now there was somebody's internet was disconnected in France after they were like called for three strikes after apparently downloading music or something.
This is the idea of three strikes doesn't necessarily bother me, but the thing
it
is,
should
no
it's
no
a
no
privacy
but
invasion.
Let me specify. Yes, there are some privacy concerns. It's completely circumventing the courts. It's basically, if I accuse Charlie Metal of stealing something three times, then
the ISP, and that's right. And the reason is either the ISP has two options: either disconnect my internet, and just be done with me and have no legal problems, or defend me and have legal problems under this pretense. Now, in the U.S., I don't think this could fly from privacy standpoint alone. The fact of the matter is that it is snooping for a wireless carrier to determine what you're actually downloading. So the question would then be, is like, what service are you using to do that, if you are at all, and why does it leave you open? But anyway, these protections that the protection supervisor warns of are absolutely 100% legitimate. And I think it's a wonderful thing that he came out and said to the public, you know, this is an act that will affect Americans, people of the European Union, New Zealand, Australia. And by the way, anytime Australia is involved with anything regarded like copyright infringement or privacy censorship, you're in trouble. So a wide ranging host of countries would be affected. And I think it's a wonderful thing that this person had the brass buttons to come out and object.
In 20 pages, no less.
In 20 pages, yeah. That's a strong objection. It's not like, hey, by the way, funny story, I don't like this.
Well, this treaty could undermine everything that we know about the internet, as it were.
Absolutely. Absolutely it could. It definitely has the right to lead to all sorts of petty, bizarre behavior that only benefits a very select and small sector of the world, and that is copyright holders. We're talking about Hollywood and the RIAA, and you know, if it's the Canadians, the CRIAA.
It's completely anti-consumer.
It's absolutely anti-consumer, and it affects, of all things, more consumers than anything else.
Taylor, did you have something? I heard you. You wanted to get your voice in there.
No, I just wanted to express my outrage. I also think it's totally ridiculous that people can be kicked off just at mere accusation.
Well, we need to calm you down. I'm going to go ahead and move on to the next story. Taylor, how would you like some 100 megabit internet across most of the U.S.?
I'd love it. I feel like it would solve most of our problems.
Yeah, most of our problems. It'd be nice. So the FCC chairman, Julius Genachowski, who is a really... I think he's a gnarly dude. This is the guy who called for, among other things, explicit net neutrality enforcement in the face of your provider, Taylor, Comcast/Xfinity's wonderful endeavors. And now he's calling for 100 megabit per second internet access for 100 million homes in the U.S. Which I think is a wonderful, ideal.
You know what I want? DOCSIS 3.0. Why don't you just give me that?
I'm sorry, DOCSIS 3.0?
Yeah, just give me DOCSIS 3.0. You know, as much as I would like 100 megabit internet, you know, I think it's quite simple. It's a over-the-wire upgrade to upgrade my modem to DOCSIS 3.0, as I understand it. And that could extremely increase my bandwidth.
Well, how is Genachowski proposing that we upgrade to 100 megabits per second?
It's a very good question.
The article
the FCC
we have
has
here
a number
at least doesn't really say. But
well, I actually...
So it is potentially DOCSIS 3.0.
Well, they in fact, there is mention of DOCSIS 3.0. I will say this about the FCC. The FCC and the Department of Commerce... specifically have funds under a year ago acts by the U.S. government. They have a lot of funds, many billions of dollars, to distribute in terms of bringing about change under wireless or wired carriers across the nation. They don't have remotely enough to instigate 100 million Americans with 100 megabits per second, but they have some ability. The FCC also does quite a lot of regulation with regard to wired carriers, and they can prod and they can poke. But I will admit that it's certainly not clear how they could enforce this. They're simply calling for it.
I think it's just important that we know that they are thinking about it.
No, absolutely. The SEC is definitely doing that, and I dare say that I think this SEC is far more altruistic than any we've seen in quite a while. I'm a big fan of Julius, and I think he does good stuff, even if he pushes the capacity and the legal authority of the FCC.
So, meanwhile, back in the rest of the 40% of the United States, what's going on there?
No broadband at all.
That's crazy. That is crazy to think about.
Yeah. Well, this goes back to the Department of Commerce, what I was talking about. Yeah, so 40% of Americans have no broadband at all. That means we're talking dial-up or none. And in a vast majority, this is something I worked with during my time in Congress, a vast majority of the extremely rural areas of the Midwest, for instance, farmers, people like that, large acreages between houses – They have no access. They have a phone, maybe. But there is...
Well, there is always satellite internet possible.
Yeah, except satellite internet in the United States is pathetic. I mean,
well, it's not great.
It's extremely expensive, and it's very slow. Now, obviously, to cite Japan, anything they do there is faster than here. They've got, you know, satellite internet in 100 megabits. And the gigabits, you know, I mean, like, these things are already being tested there. But it's not going to happen.
Japan has satellite that fast.
Yeah. Satellite, definitely in excess of 100 megabits per second. I've seen it. But one of the things that is being looked at to alleviate these poor souls without broadband connection. I mean, God knows, what are you going to do without the ability to, you know, shoot people over Gears of War 2?
Or Modern Warfare 2.
Right. I mean, that lag just kills you. Just kills you.
Quite literally.
No, so the Department of Commerce has two branches. Well, the Department of Commerce has what's called the NTIA, National Telecommunications and Information Agency, and the Department of Agriculture. And this goes back a long time, back to when the Department of Energy tried to add, you know, electricity to the homes of farmers. The Department of Agriculture said, we're not going to let you do that. And I'll tell you why. We know these people and you don't. And just give us that money. And so the Department of Agriculture started something called Rural Utility Service, RUS program. And they electrified these rural areas. And then they gave, you know, phone lines. And now they're pushing for internet service. I believe they got something in the order of $3 billion under the Stimulus Act to do that. But, you know, for now, those 40% still don't have internet, and it's all a dream. The notion is that between the NTIA, the money they received, and the Rural Utility Service, $7.2 billion, give or take, they will be able to push carriers to extend services to customers they otherwise would have deemed too costly. And we'll see where that goes. I'm not extremely optimistic just under those $7.2 billion. It's going to cost a lot more than that, but, you know, we'll take every step.
There's a lot of people out there. I think you'd be surprised because we're very tech forward, but there's a lot of people out there who just don't really want it.
Yeah, but that's going to change. I mean, the bottom line is that's absolutely going to change. With every generation, that will change. And we're talking about what's 40% of 300 million people?
It's 120 million.
That's exactly what it is. 120 million Americans have no access to broadband. I think that's something that will be addressed.
By the way, for the story, the minimum broadband – the minimum thing that is considered broadband is 200 megabits up. Or sorry, 200 kilobits up.
Yes, no, I mean, that's back to the days of ADSL and stuff.
I wouldn't mind 200 megabits up. That would be okay.
That'd be all right.
Yeah, that would be all right with
200
me.
200 megabits? Oh, man, that's brutal, dude.
No.
Come over to my house so I can share my many-fold of that.
I mean, that's not even DSL speeds. 200 megabits or 200 kilobits. Boy, now that I've said it once, I just can't get out of it.
You're confusing me.
I'm done.
This podcast will still be relevant like 100 years from now.
Oh, yeah.
It's 200 megabits. I remember when that was so slow.
You don't know this, but much like in Dune, Chris is the great tyrant.
Yeah, I am the great tyrant of this podcast. I'm also a worm.
It's true. Oh. Hey.
Well, so if you can transcend space and time.
Speaking of transcending space and time, how about we transcend the energy grid? What do you think, Chris?
I think this thing is half bull, half really cool.
Well, what thing are we talking about?
The next story is what we're talking about. Should we allude a little further?
I think you should give an explicit statement. What we're talking about.
I think you should dive in, Chris.
Oh, right. So,
what was it like in Hackers or the Lawnmower Man?
Actually, I'm really embarrassed to admit this. I've never seen Hackers. Shh.
Have you not seen Hackers?
What? That's crazy.
I'm going to put it on my Netflix.
Angelina Jolie.
Stop the presses.
Yeah, no, guys, I'm sorry. We're going to have to pause this podcast. you can resume it in week 4. But Chris really needs to go see Hackers right now.
So I can't do it in Hacker style, but I can do it. So the next story we're actually talking about to make sense of this big mess that we've created here. What is this guy's name? Let's see. CEO K.R. Srinidhar. Gotcha.
Srinidhar.
Okay. Yeah, you're better with that, with a name like that than I am. Anyways, he's talking about bringing to market. In fact, he has... brought kind of a beta product to market called the Bloombox, and it's more or less a giant fuel cell that
not so giant, very small.
Well, the little boxes that he was showing, you know, if you go to our blog, which we'll mention at the end of the show, there's a link to the article that has a video in it. The little boxes he was talking about are quite small, and he said. Two of those tiny little boxes, which were, you know, maybe a bucket size thing, maybe even a little smaller, could power a United States household.
And then, right, but those little boxes have to be insulated and all sorts of crazy stuff. So we're looking at a little refrigerator.
Right, basically a refrigerator kind of size thing. But basically, it's
small one.
It's they're fuel cells. What's the news here? I'm a little flabbergasted by
these. I think the news here is that a company was willing to... I mean, first off, a company made a huge splash by getting $400 million of just investment money. They haven't, you know, really made any money. They've definitely made fuel cells. They made fuel cells for some huge California companies, not the least of which being eBay and Staples and Google. Google was their first customer. They've offset... eBay's, I think, server power use by like 15% on clean energy.
My question is, how much did they pay in natural gas? Does that take that into account, do you think?
Well, basically what the eBay people said is that the 15% offset coupled, and we're talking about, they ordered a bunch of boxes, each of which was like $800,000. They spent a lot of money. Those 15% coupled with the use of natural gas, although actually they weren't using natural gas. They were using captured gas coming from landfills.
That's right. They were using the biofuel.
Right. But they were saving something on the order of $100,000 every 6 months.
Which is pretty wild. So is this the future or is this just glorified fuel cell box?
I'm thinking snake oil. I don't feel good about this.
Yeah, it makes me really uncomfortable. I'm.
Why? They've already made a product. I mean, the product is bigger, is for bigger companies, but they're saying 5 to 10 years we'll have some little refrigerators for you to put in your lawn to attach to a gas line.
My question is, where is the energy coming from?
The energy is coming from an extremely high temperature reaction between natural gas and oxygen.
Right, which we already do in our... The question is it more efficient than our natural gas power plants that we use now?
Yeah, how could it be that much more efficient?
Absolutely it is. It's more efficient because it's single stage. There are two kinds of interesting theories here. In terms of efficiency, we are talking about potential fuel cells can be 90% efficient, which is they recover the heat. It is total reality. It's reality. It's that this fuel cell doesn't do that. So what we're looking at is probably 45 to 55% efficient, which is still about 10% more efficient than a natural gas power plant, because a natural gas power plant burns the gas, uses the heat to turn a turbine with the steam, and then the turned turbine generates electricity. It's two stages, and it's less efficient.
You can capture 40 to 45% of the potential energy using a turbine method.
Right. Well, I'm saying that this will go to 55%. That is the guess of physicists. No. I mean, it's certainly the case that this isn't as revolutionary as they made it out to be.
What physicists? Who? I haven't seen any physicists speak up on this. That's why I am skeptical.
Well, in fact, once we post the article to the blog, there are physicists who do say up to 55%.
And there are. It's worth mentioning. I don't think. They do mention it in that video. I lied. There are some skeptics too. So we'll kind of have to just wait and see. I'm on the fence about it though. The one thing that is interesting about this is that if this is either equal or even slightly less efficient than using the conventional turbine method of generating electricity, you have the potential here for distributed power. So
absolutely, which is so important, because how much power is lost from these grids to the home?
It's about 7%, by the way.
It's an enormous percentage point. Yeah. So consider having a box in your own home yard, or maybe just a box for your block. I mean, we're talking about no loss.
I think what we're talking about here is not a replacement for power plants, which is what they kind of make it out to be in the article and in the video. I think you're more looking at an augmentation to the existing grid as it is. So you can roll back the load on the grid by using these little boxes. And even that is assuming that you have some kind of natural gas pipe coming into your block or your house or wherever you're trying to implement this.
Every block in the United States, we're talking about an urban block, has natural gas distribution in enormous numbers. And we're talking about the same natural gas that is used for a gas stove.
Sure, but, you know, not everybody has gas stoves.
Right. Well, I mean, it may be the case if this is distributed along a block or as opposed to simply individual house that then is made more substantive, more possible, simply because all that's being passed along is energy over the power lines.
I think it is really, really important to realize the limitations of this thing. And realize that it's not. This is not something that is going to solve our energy consumption problems.
No, but it can certainly, and absolutely, 150 bajillion % reduce our production of carbon dioxide, and carbon monoxide, and NOx and VOX gases.
Yeah.
Well, it runs on natural gases.
Right, but those natural gases are reduced to water.
Well, that's okay. I want to see the physicists about this.
Yeah, I'm taking a wait and see kind of approach as well. But I think the important thing is to
you can't turn hydrocarbons into water.
There's some discussion of what the actual emission is with the byproduct.
Some of it is heat.
Right. Some of it is heat. Some of it is water.
And some of it has got to be carbon dioxide.
Yeah, it's an interesting company. They had some weird patent about recovering that stuff and turning it back into energy. But it's not clear that they've shown it at all on any of their current products. I will say this. I think it's certainly an ideal we should reach to. But in the words of a serious critic who's posted on this article, you know, when we see these things 5 or 10 years down the line, they're not going to say Bloom Energy. They're going to say GE. It's just the case.
Yeah, and that will definitely be the case, is my guess. Is if we see anything like this going to market, it's going to be GE, not Bloom.
So I have a funny thing to tell you, Chris. It's something you might want to know.
Well, what's that? I'm really quite curious now.
Chris, I am never going to give you up. I'm never going to let you down. Never going to turn around, desert you. That's right, baby, because we're talking about Rickrolls.
Why, pray tell, are you talking about Rickrolls, Charlie?
Well, I think you're going to get us sued.
Am I going to get you sued?
Yeah,
no, I don't think so.
That was a public performance, mister.
This whole podcast.
I don't see anybody
going to get taken down.
Yeah, we're going to get DMCA'd.
We totally are.
It's true.
This content is not available.
The content's not available because YouTube removed Rick Astley's Never Gonna Give You Up video a couple days ago. And recently, fantastically, it reappeared. You want to tell us why, Chris?
It reappeared because their algorithm just made a mistake. That was it.
Supposedly, but I mean, this is the genesis of a long series of articles. Wasn't there somebody said that Sony, served them a DMCA takedown?
I think that was all speculation. You know, they do have algorithms, and if somebody brings up an issue, whether they're Sony or not, it's looked into.
Well, how was it this case that...
Well, the way YouTube usually works is when someone brings up a copyright violation, they pull the video down and then they look into it.
Absolutely right, which is a sort of an awful policy, but it keeps them safe and sound. But that's not the case. That's not what they're saying happened. I think what they're saying happened is that so many people got Rickrolled that they got so unhappy about it that they kept marking the video as spam. And so the video was pulled because it was called spam. And then the Twitter sphere, it just erupted.
But how did this not happen until now?
It's a good question. I mean, 30 million views later, really, why did it happen?
How did they not know?
I mean, maybe it was an automated error. I mean, it's a very silly error because now I, by the way, I just lost the game. I want to put that out there because we're talking about Rick Astley, Rick Rolling.
I cannot guarantee that any links in our show notes will not Rick Roll you. That's all I can say.
Thank God we waited till the end to discuss this article.
Can you guarantee that all of the links in the show notes will Rick Roll you?
I cannot guarantee that either.
Hey, we want people going to these sites, guys.
Oh, right, yeah. Maybe I shouldn't Rickroll people. Maybe I shouldn't Rickroll our nice listeners.
Oh, man, we should totally Rickroll our listeners.
Well, that's why you should subscribe in iTunes and then give us a positive vote.
Yes, because that totally – I have no idea what that means.
Well, no, the people who vote for us in iTunes will not be Rickrolled.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
Because they're part of the feed, you see.
Right.
So
exactly.
Wait, I take that back.
They'll be given the secret show notes.
Actually, it's really funny. I have to fix this, but in the description in iTunes, it has a bunch of HTML space characters, and then it's something about Twit meme because it's taking the HTML literally as ASCII. So I have to fix that. But that'll be fixed soon, people.
Thanks, Chris. God.
Charlie will give you the lyrics to put in its place.
Yeah, absolutely. You should contact me personally at Brother Metal on Twitter.
The first line is, we're no strangers to love.
Yes.
All right. Well, that's it. We are done here, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in. Thanks for listening to the show. You can follow us on Twitter at The End User, that's THENDUSR. And I am at Chris Hale Barnes.
And I'm at Brother Metal.
Well, you can find me on Twitter at DC Sandwiches.
The Renegade.
Why DC Sandwiches? You just like...
Oh, it's sometimes I write about sandwiches in DC.
You're a sandwich blogger.
Yeah, I am.
That is excellent.
See, look at all the stuff we're learning about ourselves. I mean, you know, Taylor, I just took you for a common drunk.
Well, I'm that too. I'm probably better at that.
Yeah, you can also find Taylor.
That's my day job.
You can also find Taylor at any bar, anywhere in the country, at any time.
At any time, it's true. I am ubiquitous. I'm a ubiquitous drink. I'm very
like
clear.
An electron cloud. He's always blinking in and out of bars.
No, I was thinking more like Beetlejuice. You say, "I'll have one beer, please," and Taylor shows up.
Really? You want that beer?
Yes. All right. Well,
anyway.
For more information,
anytime anyone is ordering a Bud Light, I'll be there. Anybody says, "Give me whatever's cold," I'll be there. Anytime anybody says,
well, unless it's a pitcher of Bud Light and we're playing Pong.
Right. Okay.
There's an exception.
Okay, but if someone's playing beer pong or flip cup, I'll be there too.
Yeah, but, all right.
Then he'll actually be there, not just in the ether. Okay, well, I'm going to cut this short. We've gone on pretty long. So for more information, check out our blog. That is theenduser.blogspot.com. Don't worry, I'm getting a domain soon. That's thendusr.blogspot.com. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Peace.